retail entrepreneurs, you know, raise their friends and family around. I am the friends and family. Nobody in my family has money. If anybody needs something, they come to me. I pay my mom's bills. We send money back home. A lot of immigrants send money back home. We have to scrap and fight and go to whatever school we can get to and work extra hard to get to any sort of level of success. It internalized this idea that I wasn't doing it right.
Hey everyone, my name is Angela. I'm your host here at Honey and Hustle. And in this episode, I'm sitting down with Kazim Rodriguez, who is one of the co-founders of Equilibrium Ventures, which is a venture capital firm based out of Winston-Salem, North Carolina. In this episode, you'll learn from an organizational psychologist and serial entrepreneur how to make mission-driven investments in your business.
Today, I am joined virtually with Kazim, who is just an incredible person and entrepreneur. And really, what I think I'm learning through our earlier conversation is just storyteller in the entrepreneurial and economic justice space. And he's done a whole lot of work here in North Carolina with organizations like Forward Cities and his own companies that have really contributed to his view on how he and we collectively can contribute to the economic prosperity of people who are often left out of funding conversations, right? So Kazim, I want to kind of not start from where we are now, because I think that is the fun part of it. So we got to let that go to the end, but start a little bit about, you know, your third exit, right? When you sold a company during the pandemic, and what that was like for you.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking the time to share space with me. You know, I had been in entrepreneurship for about 15 years. By the time I got to that company, which was my last exit, I had been through two previous exits, mergers and acquisitions before that. Had raised six rounds of venture capital up until that point. Had lived on the West Coast and kind of all, you know, all throughout the United States. I was born in New Jersey, raised in Florida, but spent most of my adult life in North Carolina, as well as a little bit of time internationally. So, you know, I had been around the block. What was interesting about the crucible in time in which my third exit happened was not just the pandemic. And we were one of those companies, we were virtualizing in clinical trials, which was a hard sell to pharma until it wasn't a hard sell. And they realized that, you know, they had billions of dollars of clinical trials that they basically had to press pause on because they couldn't have these large convenings. And so because we were in the virtualization space, it happened really, really quickly. And so in a weird way, we were one of those companies where we came out of the pandemic on a good foot. However, at that same time, we were starting to have a very important and long awaited national conversation around racial equity in the wake of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and just the countless, really, sort of public executions that we were all having to reckon with at a time when we were all working from home. I think had a lot more space and time and attention span to see what was happening. And it was undeniable because it was on video. And, you know, as that started to be raised in the public consciousness, I think we all, I hope all of us, had a little bit of an internal reckoning to try to understand, one, how has this affected me? So if you're a racialized person, how has this affected my life? Where do I fit in the tapestry of this country? I'm the son of two immigrants. I'm multiracial. I've always existed in this weird third space. I used to have to check other on government forms when it said race. You know, that is an interesting space to inhabit. And so, you know, you're kind of never you're never enough of whatever the mix is of, you know, like I'll never be Puerto Rican enough, probably. I'll never be Arab enough. I'm not Muslim. I don't speak Spanish. I'm an American. And I was raised in the South. But I never really gave myself the grace or even gave myself the time to understand how I was being affected my entire adult life through trying to assimilate into the world of entrepreneurship and venture capital and private equity and these spaces that are very, very dominated by white males. And I would have mentors my entire career who were white males. And they'd always say, you know, hey, you remind me of me when I was growing up. And the advice, which was nice, but the advice that they would give me had zero cultural appropriateness or understanding for where I came from, the things I was dealing with on a day-to-day basis. It's sort of like we tell entrepreneurs, you know, raise a friends and family around. I am the friends and family. Nobody in my family has money. Right? If anybody needs something, they come to me. I pay my mom's bills. We send money back home. A lot of immigrants send money back home. We have to scrap and fight and go to whatever school we can get to and work extra hard to get to where any sort of level of success. And so having people of privilege give me advice on how to navigate the world never made sense to me. And it internalized this idea that I wasn't doing it right. You know, why isn't it as easy for me to pick up the phone and call this, you know, like these, just pick up the phone and call the CEO, cold call him. He's a good guy. I play golf with him. You know, like I don't play golf, you know? And so all of that made me think something's wrong with me. I've got to get better. I've got to step it up. And it wasn't really until I had the time after exiting a company in the pandemic, couldn't travel, which is my favorite thing to do. I really had to sit with that. And so the first part of that journey for me was in looking at how that bias and racism was internalized in me, and realizing after looking at the data that I did not have a unique journey, that venture 96 cents of every dollar in venture capital is managed by a white person, 93 cents is managed by a white male. So it wasn't, it had nothing to do with me not being good enough or me not fitting in. Just the act of me existing in these spaces was novel, was new. And these systems were not built for me or people like you, at the intersections of people like you and me. It was built for the majority class. And entrepreneurship, venture capital, and finance is one of the last frontiers in terms of racial equity. I think the only other frontier I see beyond that is commercial real estate, is who owns the skyline of our cities. But you know, other than that, there's not another industry, I think, that is more that has more racial disparity in terms of who's managing money, who's investing money, and who gets invested in. And so when I ask the question, okay, here I am, have a lot of privilege, have a really robust network, have good bona fides, well educated, right? Like my parents met their goal. Their goal was, I want our children to have a better life than we did. Like they knocked it out of the park, right? So they succeeded. So now what is my job? I don't have kids. I'm a single guy, been married to my work my entire life. Here I am as an entrepreneur. What can I do to work on a major problem in my space of influence, in my sphere of influence? And so one of the things I thought I could do is raise a venture fund, and to do that in a way that allowed me to avoid the normal economic imperatives and pressures of venture capital, which is really all about profit and the levels of profit that they seek. It's very difficult to reach that without some level of exploitation and extraction. And when you apply those kinds of models to marginalized people, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. It can't work. But I have seen venture capital work to create incredible innovation I'm an impact guy. I've seen it change the trajectory and health of communities through technology and innovation and new ways of thinking and new ways of capitalization. And I've seen a lot of people get rich. So I've seen it work. So how can we take the aspects of what does work and how can we tweak that, honestly, through a reparations lens to move capital from where it is to where it needs to be to start to create intergenerational wealth for marginalized people? That was the question. Still figuring it out. But the one thing I had to kind of be non-negotiable about is we have to be entrepreneurial in how we try to solve these problems, which means we've got to try new things. We've got to change how we view risk. And we can't be afraid to fail. We just got to try, you know? And I think that afraid to fail, especially in venture capital, is so high because it's such a close-knit group. It's a small group of people who control a lot of money. If you're amazingly good, then you have a 10% shot of returning anything back to your LPs. And if your first one fails, good luck raising a second. So just the idea of widening the risk aperture in that those kind of pressures is generally impossible. And unfortunately, investing into people of color is perceived as a risk when people of color are not represented in the industry. And so it goes all the way up to the LPs, to the big people with the big money who invest into venture funds. They share that risk profile. And so we raised our fund primarily from foundations, which are allowed to invest into for-profit entities and such as venture funds or even directly into startups through vehicles called mission-related investments, MRI, or program-related investments, PRI. And that allows them to take the same funds that they would normally write a grant for, as long as it's mission related, and put it into a venture fund if that venture fund shares the mission of the foundation. The only really caveat is that the foundation can't be making that investment solely for financial gain. They have to be able to say, this extends our mission. So if a foundation has a mission of economic equity, racial equity, entrepreneurship in general, the social determinants of health, which is a wide umbrella, then they can use an MRI or PRI to invest into Equilibrium Impact Ventures. And we are then responsible to the LP, not just to return their money to them with some return, but we are responsible to them to tell them how our portfolio companies are furthering their mission, whatever those missions are. So I kind of talk about these. Entrepreneurs and VCs are always selling the hockey stick. You know, they're saying, yeah, in 2 years, we're going to do this and we're going to be a unicorn company. I like to say, like, in the work that I'm doing, I have to sell an impact hockey stick. I have to show foundations that, yes, you can continue to write grants to nonprofits and they do good things. However, you can also diversify your portfolio and take a small segment of that and put it into the innovation economy, in the hopes that you could create a disruptive technology or be part of creating disruptive technology to solve houselessness or economic mobility or healthcare access or food insecurity. There's so many entrepreneurs building for-profit companies that are working on those existential problems, climate change, how to leverage artificial intelligence. Like we are at a very critical cusp, I think, in the history of our species. I'm biased, but I think the best problem solvers we have are entrepreneurs. And I'm also biased that we see over and over and over again, whether it is a recession, whether it is climate change, climate migration, social justice, justice in general, the criminal justice system, all of these things, when they're broken, they disproportionately affect people of color and women and mothers and poor people. And so who should be part of building the solutions? People of color, women and mothers and poor people, because they're living it every day. They are inheriting the outcomes. And so that is a big part of why I invest in those communities. Because I see over and over again, new ways of thinking, new solutions, and a deep understanding of their target market that doesn't exist in the current majority class. It's hard to explain how to sell a product to the Black community to an investor who has no idea what that lived experience is like. So you could be sitting on a billion-dollar idea for the Latino market or the Black market or whatever, and if that investor can't see it, then you're, you know, good luck raising money. And so ultimately, the only way that I can see really changing the system and getting more than 2% of venture funding to Black founders or Latino founders is to create on-ramps for new investors of color. So ultimately, what we want to do at Equilibrium is be in a position to start seeding new venture funds, first-time fund managers, because if you're a fund manager of color, and honestly, if you're a woman fund manager, chances are it's also going to be your first fund. So it's risk upon risk upon risk upon risk. And we want to be able to be in a position to absorb that perceived risk, give people a chance to become an investor, either an angel investor or a crowdfunding investor, or run their own fund. And when I look across the capital landscape, the two places that I see dry powder that is also patient are in foundations, in philanthropy, and it's in academia. We've got hundreds of billions of dollars sitting in those two buckets that we can be a little bit creative with. And then if we can show a business case, kind of like my hero Muhammad Yunus with Grameen Bank, if you can show that it works, then everyone else will follow along. But nobody wants to be the first in the pool. And so I don't mind being the first in the pool. So I jumped in.
I like that. And before I keep going into, you know, more of the philosophy behind, you know, venture capitalism and, you know, your history with raising rounds, there's something that you said that really stuck out to me, which is that, you know, you said, I'm a single man, I've always been married to my job, right? And then you immediately proceeded to start talking about risk management. So I guess I'm curious what your thoughts are in terms of like how your work has impacted your life and relationships. And if you feel like, you know, there was ever a balance you wanted to strike that you just didn't strike or couldn't strike, and what that experience has been like for you as you've been like chasing this very heavy, hefty goal, but also like, you know, the people in your life, like, you know.
Yeah, it's a very deep question. And I'll answer that by saying I wasn't always a single man. I was married for a while. And it absolutely affected my ability to show up and balance for my relationships, not just in my partnerships, but also with friends, with family, which is why it's important for me to foster honest conversations with especially new entrepreneurs, so that they understand what they're getting into. And what the dedication level is that's required. But then also to figure out at the outset how to design your life around some sense of balance, because there is a grind culture that's completely toxic. And so even looking back at my own history, work history, and seeing where I am now, still extremely busy, but I had to teach myself and learn that okay, I can answer that email tomorrow. I can turn it all off at 5 o'clock. Like the world isn't going to burn down if I do that. And, you know, being able to develop, I think, that level of maturity is an important thing. But I don't think entrepreneurs are really given the talk. I think there is the talk that needs to happen. And I don't think it happens. I think most entrepreneurs are afraid to fail. And I think entrepreneurs need to be also prepared to succeed. So what does it mean when all of a sudden you've got paying customers? What does it mean when you raise that venture round? Do you know what that means? I know that when first time I did it, I had no idea what just happened in my life. It was, I call it the dog that catches the car. You know, you chase it, chase it, chase it. Now you got it. And it's like, oh, now I got it. So overnight, you go from being kind of an underdog. He's trying to chase this thing that, you know, is there's a very slim chance that you're going to get it. And so in your mind, you're almost always prepared to not get it. And then when you get it and you wake up one morning and it's like, I owe four people $6 million. Like, that is not something that most entrepreneurs are prepared to wake up with. Now, and I have to hold board meetings. And I now only own 60% of my company. And if I need to raise another round and I don't make it work, I'm not going to own a majority of my company anymore. Like, those kinds of realities around dilution and moving from a sort of that scrappy little team that kind of, is an underdog and is moving to do this thing and trying to raise this money that, we probably won't raise. And then once you get there, now there's other people involved in the decision making who have bosses of their own and are pressuring you to do things in your business that you may not be ready to do or willing to do, and managing all of those new relationships. It's very difficult to strike balance when you're on that sort of trajectory of success. And so I talk to entrepreneurs a lot about, yeah, be ready for failure, but also what happens if you are wildly successful? Think about that. Prepare if you're married and have a partner or a significant other or children, especially. How are you preparing your family for the possibility of wild success? What does that look like? And so my brother, he didn't graduate from medical school, but he went to medical school for a little while. And when he entered in his first rotation, the attending physician asked everybody, "Hey, raise your hand if you're married or have a boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever." And like half of the people raised their hand. And he said, "At the end of this rotation, only one or two of you will be able to raise your hand because you're going to be 48-hour shifts, 52-hour shifts. You're going to be working on 2 or 3 hours of sleep. You're not going to see them. You're not going to be able to be for them, be there with them. When you are there with them, you're not going to really be there because you're going to be sleep deprived." And that was real talk. And that's the kind of talk that, maybe not in those terms, but I think entrepreneurs need to be prepared going into the journey that, hey, if this thing takes off, that's your life. It's got to be your life. And it's your life contractually and it's your life financially, because you'll have golden handcuffs. It's not like if things go bad, you can just walk away from your own company. You can't do that. Like, you are stuck. The average relationship between an investor and an entrepreneur lasts longer than the average American marriage. You have to think about this as a long-term commitment, as serious as any long-term relationship that you're going to get into in your life. So pick your investors wisely, but also realize this is a seed you're planting that is, if it blossoms, is going to be a responsibility to take care of. And everyone around you that cares about you needs to understand that too.
That stat just blew my mind. Like, what the hell? I mean, like, I can't even wrap my head around that. But I've also never like tried to raise money. But I okay. So let me ask you this question. When you started angel investing, like, how many of those companies?
All of them in some capacity. Some of them, most of them actually are still kicking. Some of them have gone through definite, ups and downs and struggles. I try to develop a really sort of open door relationship with the entrepreneurs that, especially like my angel portfolio, because they're very, very early stage. They're all working on really tough problems. They're all people of color. It matters to me that holistic wellness matters to me. And so being able to leverage my psychology background has been hopefully, a very positive thing for those entrepreneurs. And being able to come to those conversations, not just as a psychologist who has training on staying grounded, but also as a person of color, also as an entrepreneur, also as an investor. Like, I've been appreciating more and more that particular overlap of Venn diagram doesn't exist very often in the spaces that we're inhabiting. And so, I take it as a pretty significant responsibility to show up and to hold space, especially for the folks that I invest in, because angel investors are investing their heart as much as their money. And they're doing it because they usually care about the individual founder. And they're the first ones on board, and they're willing to take the ride. So I do, I have a relationship with all of them.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for tuning into this episode. I hope you're enjoying it. If you want to be the first to receive this episode in your inbox when it drops, please subscribe to our newsletter, Please Hustle Responsibly. I share that newsletter twice a week, and I would love to have you there in the comments section, in the chat, hanging out with us. And if you would like a premium version of that newsletter to get more access to the behind the scenes of my creative business, that option is available as well. And I would love to have you in our community of creators who are growing and scaling their businesses. All right, that's all for me. Let's get back to the episode.
Think of like one of the most well-known organizational psychologists. That name that comes to mind is Adam Grant. And he's, I think, like ex-Facebook, you know, super huge guy who has a lot of opinions. But I think when I read some of his work or read some of his tweets, the only thing I can think of is like, you've never been a marginalized person in a workplace, right? I appreciate that he is an empathetic leader and that a lot of his writing tends to lend itself to those type of topics that are, and not to say that his stuff isn't relevant, it definitely is relevant for everybody that reads it, but I think there's like this added layer of just really not knowing what it truly feels like to be on the other end of a manager who is just like completely unaware of like your cultural background, or on a team where, you know, there is a significant age difference or cultural difference or gender difference, and having to cope with the realities of trying to communicate your needs upward in the workplace. And that's something that I think about now. I would say this year being 2023, I've made significant investments in the team and the, you know, other creators and subcontractors that I work with. And I always think about, well, they may not be working for me full time, but what can I do to create a space where they feel comfortable communicating their needs with me, like what they need to be successful when working with me at the bare minimum, but also recognizing that they do more than work with me. You know, they have lives, they have families, they have things that, you know, are, you know, they're trying to work through as well, good and bad. And so like, how can I create, you know, a safe workplace, a great space of communication, but also a space of reality that we're also here to get work done. So I would love to hear kind of maybe your version of the talk of what, you know, growing into being not just an entrepreneur, but a leader.
Yeah. I think that talk specifically for marginalized groups and particularly people of color has to kind of recognize that we have to simultaneously work in systems that are not just not built for us, but are also aggressive towards us. And status quo that is very difficult to change, while at the same time honoring who we are, our own culture, our own perspectives, seeing our lived experience as a massive thing of value. So changing the narrative around sort of being a person of color, being a deficit, and turning it into, no, this is an asset. This is an asset that we bring to the table. I talk about there's $4.5 trillion of buying power. This is the University of Georgia research a report. Minority buying power. I hate that term minority, but people of color, we have $4.5 trillion of worth, disposable income to pour into the economy. We're not poor. We're not uneducated. We are the next generation of business owners and consumers. And also our generation is really interested in how to spend our dollar in a way that is responsible. And so if you can't authentically talk to those consumers, then you're going to miss the wave on the economy of the future. And who better to talk to those consumers than business owners from those communities? They know what the needs are. They know the buying habits and the psychology of their communities. And so, you know, I always have to try to make a business case in my line of work, because a moral case doesn't work. And so I talk a lot about, and I promise I'm trying to answer your question. I talk a lot about the advocate and the activist. And I think about this every day. And this was taught to me by my good friend, Aisha Adams, who founded the Lenore Ryan Equity and Diversity Institute. And I was one of her first, part of her first cohort to kind of learn how to codify around some of this DEI work that I do by just existing. And I used to fight it, you know, but I can't just do what I do without also having it be DEI work just because of who I am. And so I've had to lean into that. But the idea that there's advocacy and activism, and that those are two approaches to the same ends. And a lot of people think about Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, or they think about kind of, you know, what's happening with Black Lives Matter versus what people in Congress might be able to do. And the idea is, you know, the advocate has to work inside of a system and has to figure out how to change the procedures and policies and rules of that system in order to make incremental progress that's often going to seem not good enough and way too slow to the activist. And the activist is there to continue to make sure that we're having the conversations and that we're not taking our eye off the ball. And the way that they do that is not generally politically conducive to making things happen structurally. And so the advocate has to be connected to the activist, understand the needs of the activist, understand the language of the activist, and then work within the system using their privilege to use the language of the system and the processes of the system in order to move, to sort of tack the boat towards ultimately where the activist wants to go. It's a dangerous game. And we're seeing that in the world right now, when there is not movement on policy, when things don't change for way too long, or things start getting worse and there's no political solution, then the activist has to ratchet up their approaches to getting the attention of either their government or the governments of the world, the government in their state, their community, their country, to pay attention. Hey, pay attention. And when the activist gets into the system and works as an activist, that creates extremism. And so we have to be like really, really careful in understanding who we are. Hey, like, I have to understand who I am. What are my goals? How do I go about achieving those goals? And how do I do it in a way that causes the least amount of harm to the people that I'm trying to advocate for? But I am an advocate. I am a pragmatist. That doesn't mean I won't go march on Saturday. I'll go march on Saturday and Sunday, and I'll fly to Washington and march, and I'll do whatever I need to do on my own personal time, and I'll do my activism on my own personal time. But at the end of the day, I want to see more capital get into the hands of Black and Brown folks. That's all that I care about. And when I look, the reality is 96 cents of every dollar is managed by a white person. Like, where do I got to go to get the money? That's where I got to go to get the money. So I've got to figure out how to use the structures of the system and find the capital that is willing to take the risk and be patient so that I can get those checks to Black and Brown entrepreneurs. But you know, the way that I do that, the way that I speak about that, the way that I function has to be in an advocacy role. And I have to be able to accept and communicate the virtues of incremental progress and incrementalism, which can be, you know, which can be difficult. But some of my favorite conversations are with activists, and we will argue and fight and take our positions. And at the end of the day, we'll realize we're on the same side here. And I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're here doing what you're doing, even though that's not what I'm doing. But I need you to do what you, I need you to be here. I need you to keep pushing the envelope, or I don't need you to quit, you know, and walk out of the system. I need you in the system, and I need you to, in the system creating allies in the system and doing that incremental progress. But when you're moving at the speed of academia, or you're moving at the speed of government, or you're moving at the speed of philanthropy, it's not going to be as fast as the speed of activism wants it to be. So I'll just say, like, there just has to be a level of self-awareness. And then also there can't be sort of tribalism around that, or, you know, hey, now that I'm in the system, I'm going to create a contentious relationship with the activists. That doesn't work, and you lose credibility. And, you know, I studied James Baldwin and the civil rights movement and MLK and Malcolm X and the Black Panthers, and how the FBI and other folks who didn't want to see those movements succeed used sort of those wedges to divide and conquer. We are so susceptible to that. And we're seeing that happen right now with anti-DEI, anti-woke legislation, things that are happening around LGBTQ, especially trans rights all across our country. We're going to continue to see increased violence against people of Arab descent and of Jewish faith. You know, these things are happening. Like, they are real. And so the only way that we're going to have a chance to reconcile a lot of these issues that may seem irreconcilable is to not allow ourselves to get divided, is to continue to lean into inclusion very heavily. And so a lot of my language is around, how do we include everyone? You know, Black people, Latino people, veterans, farmers, blind people, people whose English is their second language or third language, people who are neurodivergent, people who are in a wheelchair, right? It's like older people, older entrepreneurs, high school kids, elementary school kids, everyone. And if we can figure out how to be inclusive, then we'll find the things that connect us versus constantly focusing on the things that are different.
Like, because I don't know if people watching or listening kind of heard this stick out, but you, when you were talking earlier about one of your mentors saying, you know, that did not look like you, you know, you remind me of me when I was younger, right? Or when you were in this, I forget what you call it, a workshop or a cohort or an accelerator, where you were fighting against the reality that just by showing up, you were bucking the system, right? And not looking like the majority in venture capitalism or in angel investing, you know, just being there was a part of bucking the system. And I think it's very interesting, me as a Black woman business owner, right, who doesn't go around saying, hi, I'm Angela, I'm a Black woman business owner, and I da 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 da, you know? And I think that's many times how most people don't identify. Like, yes, you know, there are people who will say, you know, I'm a Black owned business, I'm a Latina owned business, I'm whatever. But I think while it is a part of their identity, I don't know in the context of entrepreneurship that they feel like that's the biggest part of their identity, right? I think the biggest part of their identity is the business. But simply by being different in this space, we recognize that we are disrupting something that is the status quo. And I think there, again, going back to the pandemic and George Floyd, there was a reckoning with that shift in how we identify as founders and as entrepreneurs, as creators, as venture capitalists, what have you, in the public space, right? Because I think there are a lot of people who are proud to be immigrant-owned business, you know, immigrant business owners or veteran-owned businesses or things like that. But it wasn't until, like, we saw that by not saying it, we were part of the erasure that is our uniqueness and our contributions to what is now the entrepreneurial ecosystem in the United States. And not just now as in 2020, I mean, now since like the beginning of, you know, time. And so I would love to hear your opinion on people that are maybe new business owners, new early stage startups, new early stage entrepreneurs who are reckoning with how do I present myself in the public space in a way that is true and authentic to me, but also values and recognizes.
It takes a lot of bravery to show up authentically and to be vulnerable. What I found is 9 times out of 10, when I lead with vulnerability, that everyone feels like they can also be vulnerable. And it's this idea of not having to compartmentalize ourselves and not having to, you know, show up and put on a face or assimilate or try to be what other people want us to be. When something very traumatic might have happened last night in the news that maybe you don't think about when you wake up because you don't have to think about it. But I didn't sleep last night because I do have to think about it. And to have the added pressure of needing to show up and not bring that part of you to work or to your business or to how you identify in a pitch is extremely harmful. And it takes the level of bravery to say, hey, I'm here, I'm showing up, I'm going to do the best that I can, but I do want you to know these are things that are on my mind. And here's why they're on my mind. And they're important because I'm a human. And you're a human. And can we start from there? I was part of a financial transaction that was happening when they stormed the Capitol in January that year. And it was literally the next day that we had a meeting with a lot of, you know, people with money, and a lot of money was on the line. And, you know, we were doing our, it was a Zoom call, all of our little squares, you know, and they ran around and said, hey, how's everybody doing? It's like, yeah, doing okay, doing all right. And they came to me and said, hey, Kasim, you know, how are you doing? And I said, I'm not okay. I'm not okay because of what I've been watching over the last day. And one of the people said, oh, is it politics? And I said, it's bigger than politics for me. Let me tell you what I saw. Let me tell you what I saw first as an American. Second, as a Southern boy. I grew up in the panhandle of Florida. Like, I spent most of my time in the South. Here's what I saw from that perspective. And then here's what I saw as a person of color. And I watched people use the Confederate flag. I watched people use the Holocaust. I watched people create nooses. I watched people defile the symbols of whatever level of freedom we have in this country. I watched them be violent. I watched them beat up cops. People died. Cops died defending our Capitol. That didn't even happen during the Revolution or the Civil War. Our Capitol didn't get stormed. And I was watching all of that as an American, as an immigrant, as a Southern American, and as a person of color. And it was traumatic for me, and it scared me. And it's not okay. And I have to think about, what would my life look like if those people were successful? And the response was, well, don't let it distract you from what we're doing here today. That was the response. And that was, for me, the light bulb in my head that said, oh, okay. Because you know what? If those people had been successful in overthrowing the government or whatever, most of the people on that call would have been okay. They might have, like, you know, I'm going to go to Portugal. I'm going to go to Canada. I'm going to go to St. Kitts or whatever, right? And write it out. Or I don't want to be an American. Or whatever the privileged response to that would be, they would be able to have that privileged response. I would be in fear of my life. And so many people of color and women and others would have been in fear for their way of life. And we see something like Roe versus Wade, and just the reaction between the people who have options and who don't have options. And over and over and over again, as I examined privileged reactions versus the reactions of people who are going to be affected by what's going on outside of politics, it's night and day. And so taking that experience into what I'm trying to do with venture capital and private equity and entrepreneurship has been really pivotal for me, because it would have gone a long way for me if they would have been able to hold space, you know, if they would have been able to say, hey, I know we've got stuff to do, but is anybody else hurting right now? Does anybody else, let's give ourselves 10 minutes to talk about that, you know, and let's just listen and let's not judge. And then we can get to business. And that would have gone like such a long way. But you can't get there if you can't empathize enough with someone and say like, oh, your entire life would be different. Like what you saw scared the crap out of you because you could be a victim of that kind of violence. Whereas I wake up in the morning and, you know, oh, what happened? I saw some of that. I kind of caught the headlines, but I didn't, you know, I was up until 3 a.m. watching the videos because I was like, what is happening? Are we going to have a country tomorrow? What does that mean for my freedom? What about my family? Is my family safe? You know what I mean? And there's so many of us who are in that position. And so, and I think it's important for me too, as I recognize my own privilege, that I go into my conversations understanding my own biases and that I am a cisgendered male, and that gives me a ton of privilege. And I'm financially stable. It gives me a ton of privilege. I have a master's degree, ton of privilege, right? I come into these spaces with a lot of privilege too, even though I'm a person of color and have these other things that I've been marginalized for. And so using that privilege, leveraging it while still honoring the things that make me me and demanding at least that people see me, it's a courageous thing. But I think we need to, especially in industries that are so, that have such disparity and such little representation, those of us who are able to get in the door and are able to get on a podcast or someone gives them a microphone or someone gives them some money, I feel like it's incumbent on us to say, here I am. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a businessman. I'm an investor. I've done all these great things, whoop-de-doo. I'm also a son of immigrants. I'm also Palestinian. I'm also grew up poor. I grew up below the poverty line. And I know what it's like to go to, you know, beg for food and use government assistance. I know what that's like. That's me too. And so showing up and saying that's me allows other people who want to take a similar path to me say, oh, okay, that guy did cool stuff. He now has privilege and he's not looking back at me and saying, why can't you do it? Because that happens a lot. If the people who get in oftentimes let the door slam behind them and then they turn around and say, hey, I came from that community. I came from these backgrounds and I made it. Why can't you make it? That's a myth of individual meritocracy. And you dishonor yourself by not realizing that you are a very small segment of the population, you know, like 0.001% of people can accomplish what you might have done. And so you can't put that on everyone else. And so I try to be really careful to realize how lucky I've been to be where I am, and then to figure out not how to make other people hustle the same way I did and sacrifice their own relationships and assimilate and learn how to play golf and do all this other BS. How do I make it easy? How do I make this easier for people? Like we have this bias that it has to be hard and, you know, the only thing worth doing are hard. In the best of circumstances, entrepreneurship is hard. How do I make it easier? I see no value in making things harder outside of ego value. I see a lot of value in using the technologies available to us, capital stacks, AI, crowdfunding, all of these different approaches to make it easier, at least easier to try. Because to me, entrepreneurship and the American dream are synonymous. And if entrepreneurship isn't readily accessible to everyone, then the American dream isn't accessible to everyone. And as an American, that's not acceptable to me.
Vulnerable conversation that we just had, and the opportunity to learn more about you, and not just, you know, the titles, the la-di-da, as you say, but really just like the person behind the ethos and the mission.
Yeah, thanks so much for holding a safe space for us. And yeah, and I'm on LinkedIn. It's kind of the easiest way to get a hold of me. So if anybody out there just wants to talk, if they're an entrepreneur, if they're an investor, if they're interested in anything that I'm doing, or if you're just having a hard time, it's like the news is rough right now, and you want to talk to somebody, I'm always open to do that as well. So we need to support each other and hold space for each other. That's an important thing for us right now. All right. Thank you, Angela.